Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of Lunch Therapy. I'm your host, unlicensed lunch therapist, Adam Roberts. My patient today is Dwight Garner. He is a book critic for the New York Times Book Review, and he is the author of the brand new book, The Upstairs Delicatessen, on eating, reading, reading about eating, and eating while reading. He's one of my favorite book critics, so I was super excited and slightly nervous to talk to him today. And in today's episode, we talk all about being open in his writing.
I feel like I'm pretty open about my life. I feel like I'm a platter of cold cuts. You know, anyone can take a slice.
Getting into organ meat.
No one really wants a whole plate of kidneys, like a big, big honking plate of kidneys, right? You don't.
And on not being pretentious.
You know, if you can't take a bit of pretension in this world, you're always going to be in the shallow end of the swimming pool, you know, because a lot of the great things are a little pretentious.
So without further ado, here is my lunch therapy session with Dwight Garner. All right, Dwight. Well, it's very exciting to talk to you. I've been a fan of yours for a long time, and congratulations on your new book. How does it feel to have it out there?
Thank you. You know, I'm really excited about it. I mean, I've always been on the other side, really. You know, I review other people's books. And, you know, when you're a book critic, you read so many books and you really think hard about, you know, is the book you're going to publish a useful book? Does anyone need it? You know, sometimes I get a book and think, well, why? You know, why do we even published, really? and I tried to make a book that points readers to and eaters to other books.
Yeah. And it does. I mean, I bought How to Be Idle. Reading, because you said it was the only book you've read twice, right? Is that something?
The only self-help book I've read twice.
Because self-help book.
I hate that genre. Now they've banned. I was in my local bookstore the other day, my local Barnes and Noble, and they had banned. There's no longer a self-help section now. It's called, I think, self-therapy. You know, but anyway. But you know, he has a magazine. That guy who wrote How to Be Idle. It's called The Idler. And it's great. I subscribe and I recommend it.
Well, it's been really great for me to read your book, especially because I've been doing this podcast about lunch for about 3 years. And the way your book is divided, it's like breakfast, lunch, dinner, and you have a whole chapter on lunch. And it made me feel good because the whole premise of this podcast is that what you eat for lunch reveals something about who you are. And I feel like your chapter on lunch really does kind of emphasize that point. And one of the things I really liked about how you started about that with that chapter was about the idea of American Puritanism and this idea that lunch should be eaten quickly and you have to get through it versus sitting down to a long lunch. And I'm curious for you, I mean, you talk about this in the book, but for those who haven't read it yet, can you talk a little bit about your lunch habits in general and how you think about lunch?
Well, my dirty secret is that, you know, if you're someone who has to read all day, all the time, I try not to get too comfortable and overeat at lunch, because if I do, I'm going to be napping, you know, like 45 minutes. So day in, day out, I kind of eat slightly on the light side. But having said that, at least once or twice a month, I'll go out for a pretty serious, quote unquote, lunch, like a literary old school lunch. And you know, I might have a drink, you know. I once tried to do 3 martinis just as a kind of as a fun thing. Let's all go do 3 martinis. And I swear to God, I just went home and like, I barely got home. First of all.
Yeah. 3 martinis is a lot. Like 2 martinis I'm done for. So I can't imagine 3 martinis.
I still don't know how people did it. But anyway, when I'm home, I mean, I eat pretty simply, you know, cold cuts on a platter or a peanut butter and pickle sandwich or leftovers a lot, you know?
Yeah.
I don't make a big production of it, but I like the big production and I like having, ideally it's a Friday and you go out and you go somewhere nice and you have a couple glasses of wine and you have a really civilized lunch. And I look forward to those.
I feel like New York is also really unique in that you have these like old bastions of fine dining that you can go to for lunch, because a lot of cities don't have these like historic restaurants or these places you can go and have a grand lunch. So it's very tempting here, although as you mentioned in the book, it's also very expensive. So you mentioned your peanut butter and pickle sandwich, and as research for this podcast, I read your article about it, and it was a funny article because you sort of talk about how much you've loved this combination of peanut butter and pickles, but then when you share it with other food writers, they sort of poo-poo it. And I'm curious, since you've written that article, do you feel like it's caught on at all, peanut butter and pickles?
You know, I do. I hear from people now, you know. And the Times even did a little recipe, an updated recipe. They put sriracha in theirs or something. you know, the reason it's great, not only is it delicious and it's related to, I think, a satay or a mole in its flavor combinations. Mm-hmm. It never occurred to me that it was sophisticated. My dad always ate them when I was a kid. They got him through law school in West Virginia. And I always thought they were gross too, you know, when I was a kid, but then I bought one in my 30s. I was like, that's pretty good. And the great thing about it is it's not only really good, but it's always there for you. You know, you might come up, look for lunch and there's no more cold cuts and the soup's all it. And peanut butter and pickle, it's delicious. It's always there, usually around to make. And I really enjoy them.
Yeah, it feels like the adult version of peanut butter and jelly, because actually we have peanut butter and jelly in our house. So my husband will make that for himself. But I feel like you're graduating to a more, you know, adult level by doing pickles instead of jelly. It's less sweet.
Yeah, tell him the gateway drug will be the sweet pickles, you know.
Oh yeah. we have cornichons in our refrigerator and we have peanut butter, and I almost did that, but I thought that might be a little kind of breaking the rules of your peanut butter and pickle sandwich. It felt like cornichons were a little too tart.
No, you know, actually the big realization is that anything pickled is delicious. I mean, even kimchi is great. Any kind of pickled vegetable I find to be delicious with peanut butter. But anyway,
well, one thing I wanted to ask you before we get to your lunch today, because that's what the bulk of this podcast will be, analyzing your lunch. You know, you read so much. You're such a great reader. And I love reading. I mean, my two favorite things are reading and eating. So your book is right up my alley. But, you know, as somebody, I'm sure you do too, who's, you know, has a phone in their pocket and has Instagram and email and the news coming in and all this stuff, how do you stay focused when you read? Because it's something I'm really curious about.
You're right to point that out, because like everyone else, I'm addicted to my phone. What I do when I'm reading for work, like today, I need to read. I have probably 300 pages to finish today, because it's a lot. You know, if most people read, I would say 40, 50 pages an hour. I think that's pretty average, 30 to 50. Mm-hmm. That's about what I read. And, you know, I'm looking at 6 or 7 hours still today. And it's a lot. And what I tend to do is set my phone for an hour and I just put it away. And I until it beeps, I can't check my email, can't do anything. And so it beeps and it reminds me to get up and I don't know, stretch a little bit, maybe wash a few dishes, look at my Twitter, and then come back and read for another hour. That's my method.
And it's great that you can do that. I mean, for me, like, my brain is so rewired because of my phone that I feel like I can look down at I'm reading a book, but then I just feel that pull, that, like, you know, want that serotonin or whatever that is that you get when you look at your phone. So I mean, setting the timer for an hour sounds like a good strategy. But even just in terms of reading, you know, I'm a slow reader, and I'm just so curious about your reading style, because it seems to me like to get through as many books as you need to get through, it's not like you're soaking in each sentence slowly. It's like you kind of have to push through. Like, do you find yourself like rereading passages? Do you find yourself, you know, going back through what you just read because your brain wandered off, or will you just keep pushing forward?
No, you're right to bring that up. I think that happens to everyone, right? You find that you miss two paragraphs because you're thinking about the fact that you need to pick this thing up for your wife, whatever.
Right.
You know, your mind is suddenly gone. So yeah, I go back and reread. I think I don't think I read faster than anyone else. I think that I just have the time and I also love it. But, you know, the average person can read a book in about 8 hours, you know, and for most people doing half an hour a day, you know, it's a couple of weeks and maybe 3 weeks by the time they get it all done. Because it's my job, I can often do it in a day, you know, because I'll just make it happen. I don't like reading one book in a day. It's a little much because I need breaks. And I do that sometimes because I have to, and I don't like it. It feels a little like horse feeding. Or it reminds me of being in college again when you have to paper on Moby Dick in 3 days. You're like, oh God. And you haven't started it. but I don't skim. I never skim. And I'll tell you why. I mean, A, it feels like cheating, but you know, we all cheat in our own ways, but I don't want to miss anything. You know, you want your book reviews to be definitive. You want to be able to say, you know, not once in this book does he mention his wife who was there for 50 years. And then you're going to skim and miss the wife, you know, and then something's embarrassing. So I find myself never giving in to the temptation to skim anything.
I'm curious with your methodology, because I have Garner's Quotations, which is your other book. And it's such a delight to like read all these quotes. And the new book sort of has quotes for every subject that you get into, whether it's hot dogs, whether it's coffee, whether it's tea. And I'm curious, like, when you're collecting these quotations and these quotes, I mean, is the cataloging your brain? Is it in a giant binder? Like, how do you organize all this stuff?
Well, I have a pretty good memory, A, but B, I have kept, since I was a teenager, a commonplace book. It used to be on paper, where I would write down favorite passages from things that I've read, you know, and it started really sort of simply with a few, you know, a passage from Jack Kerouac or, you know, something I read when I was a teenager, you know, J.D. Salinger. And it's become I'm kind of obsessive now, a bit of a hoarder in terms of language. What I do is I read a book, let's say for work, I read a novel. And anytime there's a great sentence in it, and by that, I don't mean a flashy style necessarily. I mean, just a really strong observation about life. It could be about driving or sex or social class or violence or, you know, cars. I already said that. You name it. And I will go through the book when I'm done. And this is my book. Hello.
Oh, yeah, there it is.
When I'm done, and I will look at every page and I'll type that great observation about what it's like to drive Route 66 or whatever, and I'll type it in on this list under cars. And so I have this amazing, I hope that maybe when I die, I'll have this crazy masterpiece of quotations that no one knows, but I doubt it. I think it's just something I do, and it helps me sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty remarkable. It feels like you have a quotation for everything in a weird way.
I try not to be a quotations bore. You know, I'm the kind of person, if we're out, everything reminds me of something, you know, and I'm always like, oh, yeah. X said, which could be a really, really disgusting habit. So I try to keep it cool.
No, it's great. Okay, well, let's jump into lunch and then we'll backtrack into some of these other book questions. So Dwight, what did you have for lunch today?
Well, I'm embarrassed because we've already talked about it. I had a peanut butter pickle sandwich.
Oh, no, I spoiled it. Okay.
I could make something else up. I mean, you know.
No. I was hoping you would have that, actually. So that actually works. I mean, we can still talk about it.
All right.
Can you tell us specifically, like, what kind of bread you had today? What kind of pickles? What kind of peanut butter? Was it a specific brand? Crunchy, smooth?
Yeah, I can. I'll preface this by saying I'm not everyone's a bit of an ingredient snob, but you know, I don't have my favorite peanut butter brand. I have favorite brands in some things, but I don't have a favorite. My wife buys good organic peanut butter and good organic bread for the most part. And I like sour pickles. So in New York, there's a lot of pickle makers, so it's easy to get groovy pickles, you know, but elsewhere in the country, I really like Clausen's, the ones that are, you know, in the cold section.
Yeah.
I find much snappier and they're much brighter and snappier than other kinds you buy that are, you know, on the shelf and not cold.
Is that a spear? Like you're putting a pickle spear on the sandwich or is it sliced?
Good question.
Pickle?
I've done all ways. I started with slices, but now my favorite thing is to eat them open faced and take a big honking pickle, cut it down the middle in half long and lay the two sides like their bodies face down on the bread, you know, so big hunks. The older I get, the more I like more pickle and less peanut butter with it. I still like the peanut butter, but I would say pickle predominates in the peanut butter adds this sort of big little base note at the bottom of it, you know.
Go ahead.
I can talk about brands though if you want me to. I mean, this morning we have this bread. You ever bread alone? It's this sort of organic.
We buy it from the farmer's market. Yeah.
Right. It's great. You know, it's pretty easy to find as good things go. And when we see it, we tend to buy two loaves and put one in the freezer because then, like this morning, I didn't have any bread in the house because I still don't have any bread in the house. And so there was a slice that just popped out of the freezer. And as you know, you put it in the toaster and it's like brand new again in 1 minute, you know? So I used a piece of whole wheat sourdough from Bread Alone, which has been in there for 3 months. And then let's see, I have it here. Peanut Butter and Company, peanut butter. Do you remember Peanut Butter and Company?
Yeah, it was in the West Village, right? It was sort of a little.
And it's not there anymore. I will always love the guy who owned it. I might screw up his name, but I believe it's Lee Zalban, slightly off. He was the only guy when I wrote my peanut butter and pickle article who immediately said, yes, you know, this is great. He had it on his menu. And I was like, I love you, Lee. And his company still makes peanut butter and it's very good.
I see it in the stores. Yeah, I mean, I'm an old school like Skippy Jif peanut butter person just because there's something about the way those whatever chemicals they put in there just tastes like childhood to me.
Oh.
So the more natural it is, the less like appealing. But I know I should probably go to the fancier peanut butters. Curious.
I totally get that. I'm from West Virginia. I love that stuff too. I happen to live with a woman who sort of grew up in this quote unquote elite food family.
Yes.
She's always taking my things like Jif and kind of pushing them away and putting some thing in there instead. You know, I think my habits embarrass her sometimes.
First of all, we should say your wife Cree, when I was reading your book, I didn't realize that she's a cookbook author and a novelist. And so she has a bunch of cookbooks that are really cool. So I'll have to have her on this podcast too. I was also going to say, we talked about toast and you have a whole section in your book about toast and how Amanda, I think you said Amanda Hesser doesn't own a toaster. Somebody doesn't own a toaster.
Yeah.
And then George Orwell would make his on the stovetop until it was toast it all the way through, right? Is that the idea?
I think that was it. Yeah. Or Beckett Wood, I forget now. But but Amanda Hesser, whom I revere, wrote somewhere, she thinks that toasters are ugly and take up too much space in the kitchen.
Yeah.
I was like, holy cow, I use my toaster all the time. I mean, it's really, you know, I can't imagine living without it. And it's how annoying to put it in the oven. I think it would take 20 minutes, you know, anyway.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, in terms of that, so the premise of this podcast is you say what you had for lunch and then we sort of see what it reveals about you. And for some reason, I kind of feel a peanut butter and pickle sandwich is actually emblematic of sort of like your overall brand philosophy approach to literature as well as food, which is that there's a lot of thought that goes into it, but it's not pretentious or, you know, fancy highbrow, you know, looking down from your monocle. It's like it's very of the people. Like anybody can you know, read the books with the same enthusiasm that you do, and anyone can eat a peanut butter and pickle sandwich. There's something about it that's very human and real and not pretentious, but maybe I'm far off. Do you feel like, do you see any connection there?
No, I really appreciate that. I mean, I like art that's pretentious sometimes, and I like critics that are pretentious sometimes. And, you know, if you can't take a bit of pretension in this world, you're always going to be in the shallow end of the swimming pool, you know, because right. A lot of the great things are a little pretentious.
Sure.
But I try not to be, you know, and I like things, and I like writers that are a little bit funny, you know, and I hope that I can be funny. I mean, it's hard to be funny. It's really hard. You want to be funny. And I mean, just because you're not laying it on thick in a highbrow way doesn't mean you're not serious, you know, and I'd like to think my stuff is serious, but I like some wit and some plain talk, I guess, you know?
Yeah. And you're always very honest in your reviews. You know, it's funny because I was catching up on some of your reviews recently, and it's sort of just like truth-telling feels like your MO in terms of writing these reviews, that, you know, no matter what, you're going to, like the one you just wrote about the author whose work you loved, I think she's from West Virginia.
Yeah. Jane Ann Phillips.
And in your review, you said that you adore her other books, but this particular work that she just wrote didn't work at all. And you kind of just go right into it. And I'm curious, as a critic, do you have hesitations when you're at your keyboard typing these reviews? Like, do you worry about how it's going to be perceived by that author, or are you able to just sort of put it all out there?
You know, it's a good question. I do think about it sometimes. I will say that what you don't want to do as a critic is hit some young writer over the head with a first book out or something minor, you know, because who wants to read a review that says, you know, this thing you've never heard of? Well, it's not any good. Like, who cares? Like, why, you know?
Yeah.
But having said that, I will say that if there's a first novel and it's gotten a lot of attention and reviews everywhere, and it's, you know, then if I have a dissenting opinion, maybe it's worth saying, you know, because it's already out there. I mean, it's the balloon has been launched, and let's have the conversation now, you know? So I will review a first novel negatively if in a situation like that, you know, if it's really been ballyhooed in some way. But, you know, someone like Jane Ann Phillips, for example, she's been around for 40 years. She's won every major award there is to win. She's a maid, in the mafia terms, a made man. Like, you know what I mean?
She's going to be okay.
She's going to be okay. And so I just said my piece. And, you know, I try not to be pointlessly cruel. I don't want to do that. But I do feel like readers appreciate plain talk. And whenever I write a negative review, I tend to get a lot of response from readers, because I think the literary world has gotten pretty nicey-nice.
Yeah.
Or more rarely negative. And I think that a lot of readers are often, you know, told to buy books they end up finding to be not very good, because everyone's afraid to say a negative word. And somehow someone's saying, yes, this is pretty bad, it resonates with them. Like, finally, you know, it's like reading a Consumer Report. Like, finally someone is telling me that this thing isn't any good. So it's a balancing act.
And what about your real life? Like, being in New York in the milieu that you're in, do you run into the people whose work that you review? And have you had any awkward encounters with somebody whose book you gave a bad review to?
That's such a great question. Almost never. The reason is that I tend not to go to literary parties in places where, because it's not good for anyone. I try not to meet too many writers. I mean, my best friends are writers, but they've known me for a long time and they know I can't review them. But it's no good for you if you meet me, because if we become friends, you and I, and you write a book, well, you know, we're friends now. I can't review it, you know, so I stay away. Once or twice, you know, someone's declined to shake my hand and stalked away, you know. And once I saw, I won't even name her name because it'll get too weirdly personal, but a music figure whom I revere, that I didn't like the memoir this person wrote very much. And I saw her coming towards me at a thing, and I kind of ran away because I don't want mine. I can face anybody, but I revere this person. I did not want to see this human being kind of like give me the hairy eyeball. So, you know, I kind of sidled away, but in general, no.
It's funny. I mean, I worked for a while at Serious Eats. So I did read your review of Ed Levine's book when it came out.
Oh, man.
And that was kind of brutal. But at the same time, it feels like you were just being honest and shooting from the hip. And so, you know,
well,
that was
the kind of book where, I mean, I revere Ed. I said that in my piece. I know
you did.
A tiny bit, and he's great. But it's kind of book that he like used the same word three times in the first paragraph. Yeah. It was clearly just not he must have written it in an Uber or something. I mean, I don't know, you know, but he's really good. I mean, he knows a lot and he is capable of good writing. So anyway.
Got it. Well, I'm curious. I mean, it's interesting that you have a book out, because I was thinking about this. I was thinking, like, theater critics don't put on a play. Food critics don't open a restaurant. You know, dance critics don't do the ballet. But like, as a book critic, you have just written a book. And are you, is that an animal?
Right. This is Maybell.
Hold on 1 second. Yeah. I'll introduce you, Maybell.
We have to get you. Like Maybell,
Winston. And
who do we have there?
This is Winston.
Hey, Winston. Like Orwell, like 1984 Winston?
No, actually, well, Winston Churchill, because we thought he was a corgi, but it turns out he's a chihuahua. So it was
a chihuahua in her too.
Yeah.
Dachshund, I think. So
That's exactly what he is, a chihuahua dachshund with Pomeranian. So
yeah, it's a good mix. She's adorable. You know, I mean, she's really sweet dog. So
anyway. Unfortunately, people can't see this, but they can hear it. So I was going to ask you, as a book critic writing a book, is it hard to get out of your own head when you're writing your own material? Like, does the critic voice rise up and say, you know, Dwight, what are you doing? This is terrible prose.
Yeah, that's another really good question. It does, but I don't know. My deadline was tight enough that I had to just sort of beat myself over the head to write it, because, you know, my day job at the Times is pretty involving most of the time. Like, I'm pretty busy. Some weeks are pretty quiet. I might review a first novel or a book of poems, and there's not a lot of background work to do, and it's a pretty easy week. But often I'll be reviewing a fourth novel and I have to go back and read the previous three or something. And it's just, I'm always just barely keeping up, it seems like. And so to write this book, I meant a lot of mornings waking up extra early. And, you know, if you wake up at 5 a.m. and try to work for 3 hours, there's no room for the negative voices in your head to come out. But I did definitely feel that. And, you know, my book's about to get reviewed, I think, by some places, you know, and I'm trying to steel myself, you know, I've dished it out. I have to be able to take it. So, you know, I'm gonna have to fortify myself with more peanut butter sandwiches.
Well, I'm curious that for those who don't know, I mean, I've read it, the introduction now that explains it, but can you tell us why the book is called The Upstairs Delicatessen?
Yeah, there's this great American literary critic named Seymour Krim. And Seymour Krim has mostly been forgotten. He has some collections out there with great titles, like The Nearsighted Cannoneer is one of them. And he wrote in the 50s and 60s and early 70s. And he had this phrase in one of his columns. He described his own memory as this profuse upstairs delicatessen of mine. And I just thought, what a great phrase that is, you know, because we all have that kind of delicatessen. We all have this upstairs delicatessen. Mm-hmm. And it seemed perfect, because this book is when I go through my day of eating and shopping, you know, I have these voices in my head that I relate to the toast and the pickles. And so this book is about my own upstairs delicatessen. And yeah, that's it.
Well, you and I have a similar history, in the sense that part of your story in the book is moving from West Virginia to Florida. And my family moved us when I was 11 from Long Island to Boca Raton, Florida. So I had that Florida childhood too. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about, I mean, you talk in the book, it's such a great image of you going to school, gathering up a bunch of reading material and coming home and making snacks for yourself and sort of eating and reading at the same time. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about your childhood and how food and literature kind of intertwined for you.
Oh man, that's a big question. I was born in Fairmont, West Virginia, a little mining town. My grandfather Archie was a coal miner. My father went to law school at the University of West Virginia. excuse me, West Virginia University. I got that backwards in print once, and people still mock me to this day. You know, they were just tired of the cold, my mother and father, and moved us to Naples, Florida, which turned out to be, it seemed kind of honky-tonk back then to me, or small, you know.
Yeah.
What used to be dirt roads are now 10-lane highways in that town. It, you know, it's been the fastest growing area in America now for 50 years or something. So it's
really? I didn't know that.
Except for the small downtown called Old Naples, it's almost unrecognizable to me. But, you know, I grew up there, and, it's an outdoor place where every day is sunny. And I'm an indoor kind of guy. I like rainy days, you know? So everyone's always kicking me around, telling me to get outside. And I didn't want to go outside. You know, I mean, I went outside enough. I'm not a snail in a shell or anything. But
yeah, my dad used to call me indoor boy growing up because I loved the great indoors. So I totally relate to that. Yes.
I got to stop and tell you, a long time ago, Outside Magazine was feeling me out for a job. They called me and had an open editorship somewhere. And I said, I might work for you if you were called Inside Magazine. and they said, don't worry, our editor's idea of adventure is not having wine at lunch. And I said, that's a great response.
Inside Magazine is one I would gladly subscribe to. So maybe you're onto something there.
When Hugh Hefner founded Playboy, we're talking the 50s here. He wrote something in his first introduction. I don't know how I know this. I think I read a biography of Hefner or something once. And he said, don't expect us to be outside a lot. We're inside guys. We have our hi-fi. You know, we're Miles Davis in movies. And like,
we're inside guys. We got ours right there. Yeah.
Right.
Totally. So you were saying, you were growing up in Florida, you didn't like the great outdoors, you wanted to be inside, and that's when you started reading so much?
Yeah. I mean, I was always, I think, one of those weird kids who just read a ton. I don't know why. You know, I think, you know, part of what this book is about, and part of my favorite people, I think, are people who are A, really game in life, you know, up for things, and B, curious, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just don't understand people who, you know, I grew up in Florida, and it was in the 70s and everyone ate the same kind of food, you know, beef stroganoff and, you know, just basic American. It was great. I loved it. But you start reading, you know, if any kind of curiosity, you start reading and you read, you know, my God, you know, what's a fresh oyster or I don't know, or not even that fancy. What is like great Cajun sausage or mm-hmm. you know, why do people care this much about fried chicken? I get it from KFC and it's okay. But, you know, why is this like a thing? And you start slowly. Yeah, I got to try that. And then you try this and you read this and it leads you to this and you listen to this and it leads you to that. You grow up and you get, you know, you develop taste, you know.
Yes.
You know, so many people, I mean, to rag on them, they have wonderful lives, but who, you know, develop their tastes early and they kind of harden and they don't really move from them. And I can see the point of that, I guess. Everyone likes comfort, but it's just not my, you know, it's not my thing. To get back to your question, I just love books, you know, and I would just read all the time. I was one of those kids. And I always noticed the food when I was reading. You know, I remember reading Robert B. Parker's spy novels or his, you know, his Spencer novels when I was young. And he was really into food, Spencer. And at the time, it was rare to find like a tough guy who really cared about his pasta. You know, I was like, wow. You know, and I think I tried to cook, you know, some of the things he talked about.
Isn't Nero Wolfe also a detective who was really into food? One of my friends turned me on to him a little bit, and that was fun to read.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I would just notice the food, you know, and I really like to eat and read at the same time, you know, I still do, you know, like when I had lunch today, I was sitting there and I just sitting at my table in my living room and flipping the New York Times, you know, and I get involved in something. The sandwich is gone. I'll make another half, you know, come back. And
right.
You know? So I was pretty chubby as a kid. I've never been thin. I'm still not thin, but I used to be pretty dang chubby. And, these things were linked, I think. Anyway,
eating and reading. Yeah, I mean, it's the two things I love the most. And there's a certain kind of comfort. I'm just thinking of the idea of like taking in, and like when you're reading, you're taking in thoughts, ideas, material. It's like, when you're eating, obviously you're taking in food. So there is something about almost being like a vacuum cleaner for culture and content and ideas and tastes and sensations. Like that all kind of makes sense to me that the two things are interconnected. But I was going to say, I mean, do you still have family in Florida now? Because for me, I have a niece and nephew who are growing up there. And to bring it back to books for a second, in Florida, it's just been so upsetting with the book banning that's going on there. And I just think about some of the books that I read in school when I was growing up in Florida. Like I read The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison in high school. And I think that's one of the books that's being banned there. So, you know, there's something very what's the word, like poignant to me that you got out of Florida as a reader, but now people who are growing up there might not have the same access to the books that you did. And is that something you think about?
Well, you know, let me be honest. I have a counterintuitive take on book bans. Clive James, who's one of my favorite writers, the British critic and memoirist, said, you know, here's my idea for making poetry popular again in schools. Ban it.
I don't know.
If I were a kid in Florida right now and I read this list of banned books, those are the books I'm going to find.
They're very findable.
I mean, you know, and it strikes me as bizarre that people pick on books to ban when you look at your phone. I mean, the whole disgusting world at every second is pouring through kids' phones. I mean, not just pornography, but we all know. And they're picking like Toni Morrison to ban. I mean, it's just stupid. I mean, it's just, you know, and I think it will backfire. I really do.
Yeah, I think so too. Well, I'm going to shift a little bit. I read your Grub Street Diet, which was terrific, where you kept a catalog of everything you ate for a week. And part of what you mentioned in there is that you're a member of an offal or awful eating society. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's this group in New York called the Organ Meat Society, and it's been around since the 90s. And, you know, I'm a big eater and I'm curious. So I kind of knew about it. I'd read about it somewhere. In the back of my mind, I'm like, oh, that's so cool. You know, I didn't know how to find it. You know, I'm the kind of guy who once in a while would get the calf's liver in a restaurant or the kidneys, but I didn't know about this. And then I was at a dinner party. Someone invited me to a party and an editor or something. And there at the end of the table was Daniel Okrent, who was the first New York Times public editor, ombudsman, and he also invented rotisserie baseball, and he's a great man of letters, whatever. But I knew, I remember that he was the Organ Meat Society founder. So I made a point of going over there, you know, and luckily I was loaded because I knew all about organ meats and I was excited. And I think I forced him into inviting me in, you know, or inviting me to a meal. And he did. And so this was maybe 8 years ago, some Chinese restaurant on 14th Street. I think it was called Auntie Guan's Kitchen. It's still there. And I get to meet all these great people who meet once a month or so to eat organ meats, you know, and it's not a big group. It's like 15 people. And they don't want it to grow because when I say they, I mean, you know, Daniel Okrent and the food critic Robert Sietsema are kind of the two presiding members of the Organ Meat Society. And they don't want it to grow because once you get too large, you can't all sit at the same table. You know, I mean, it'd be great to have 30 people, but then, you know, you can't. And a lot of the restaurants we go to, they don't take reservations, and it's really hard to get a group even of eight in sometimes. So it stays small on purpose. People keep reaching out to me after that article and saying, I want to be a member too. And I tell them, well, why aren't there more organ meat societies? You know, start your own. I mean, it's not that hard.
And is there any organ meat that you don't like, or will you eat it all?
You know, I eat it all. I will say I'm not a huge, I don't leap into the fray when people are fighting over the fish eyes. There's always about three people like, oh, give me the fish eye. I'm like, fine, take the fish eye. But I will eat them. But, you know, it's a texture thing for me. I don't love them. And yet, I'm pretty omnivorous. I'll eat almost anything that's legitimately edible, you know, so.
It's funny because I always feel like it's a badge of honor in the food world to eat offal and eat brains and eat. But as I get older, I have to admit that I don't think I love it. Like I'm open to experiencing it. I mean, I grew up eating chopped liver, I should say, as a Jewish person. So that I like. Yep. But I've had enough now of like, you know, I had the testicles at Damaka at the Indian restaurant. I've had all that stuff. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's the novelty that makes it more exciting than the actual taste of it. But do you actually really like the taste of offal?
Well, I have two things to say about that. One, I often love the taste when it comes to liver, for example, or tripe. You know, tripe doesn't necessarily have a taste, but chefs who use good stock and really bring out the, you know, the thing about tripe. And I often like the taste. I usually like the taste because chefs who know what they're doing, you know, can really with liver and kidneys and brains. I like brain. This will make me sound like a world traveler. I'm not in a big way, but I got invited to a literary festival in Pakistan one year. And I heard someone mention that there was the local specialty was brains masala. And I happened to mention, the woman I was with, like, cooked it for me. And it was so great. But I will say about, if you're curious about organ meats, my advice to people is no one really wants a whole plate of kidneys, like a big, big honking plate of kidneys, right? You don't. So if you want to taste this stuff and have fun, get eight people, have someone order for the table. Get other things. You know, if you're a Chinese restaurant, get dumplings and, you know, and get get the intestines, get the chicken feet, get the, and everyone just takes some. And it's not like you're, it's oppressive to have a huge plate of chicken feet, but like
right.
excellent, you know? So all things in moderation.
What was the quote in your book that's like about the urine taste of kidneys, or it mentions it's like George Orwell or somebody?
That's James Joyce. Yeah.
James Joyce.
Breakfast in Ulysses. Yeah.
The urine tang or something of the kidneys. Well, one thing that you mentioned in your book kind of offhandedly, but that was very exciting for me, is I love collecting cookbooks. I have tons. We just moved back to Brooklyn from Los Angeles and I had to kind of cull my collection, but you say you have 400 cookbooks in a storage locker. And so I'm curious, can you talk about collecting cookbooks and whether they're still in the locker and how often you pull them out and what your favorites are?
Yeah, you know, I got 200 of them out. My favorite 200, I think, I got them out. There's still 200 in storage. But I just love, that's why, you know, I just pull them out sometimes, just look at them, like during lunch, because I love flipping through. And yeah, I bought them since I was young. They're all kinds, you know, we keep them in, you know, they're kind of like, you know, the Indian cookbooks are one section and the Southern cookbooks over here. And you know, a lot of classic ones. I just love browsing through bookstores looking for them because there's still good finds to be had, you know. I mean, books used in rare book shopping has gotten harder thanks to the internet because everyone knows what they have now and everything's marked up, you know, right, to what the world is charging for it. And so it's a little harder, but a lot of cookbooks, good ones, are still relatively inexpensive to find on the used market. And my favorite ones, God, you know, I love all kinds of cookbooks, but I find myself returning to the ones that are just anthologies of great, you know, like the New York Times cookbook is so great because it's not just one person. It's like they've called from 100 chefs. And so Matt Hesser edited the New York Times cookbook. I'm not trying to blow the horn of my own company, but I love the book because she took recipes from all over the world and they, you know, put them in this book. So it's
I need to get the latest copy. I had the older one. I remember Gourmet had a giant cookbook before the magazine ended. That was a great anthology.
I have Gourmets. I love the one from Saveur magazine. It's I have it myself. Where'd it go? Oh, I just moved
it. I have Saveur Cooks French. That's a great one. Yeah.
Yeah. And like Jacques Pepin's, I like everything about Jacques Pepin, but he has one or two books that are sort of Jacques' greatest hits, you know? And you know, it's 4 o'clock and I don't know what's for dinner. I'll pull that out sometimes because he's really reliable and his recipes tend not to be super complicated most of the time. And yeah, you know, my fish cookbooks are right there. My grilling cookbooks. And anyway,
Are they all practical or do you collect any cookbooks just for the vintage, like the collectors? Like I was just looking over here. I have the Lutece cookbook that I got a used copy from Andre Sultner back when he had Lutece, you know, things like that where I don't necessarily cook for them, but I love them as objects. Do you have any books like that?
You know, I have the Lutece cookbook too. I can see it. Right.
Really? That's amazing.
You know, it's funny. I used to collect, and I've kind of given this up, although I think there are a bunch in storage, the cookbooks from like celebrities, because they're so goofy, you know, like the Mike Douglas cookbook. No one remembers Mike Douglas anymore, but, or you know, I don't know.
Well, you mentioned the Pearl Bailey cookbook in your book that you quote from that. And made me kind of want to check that out.
Yeah. Pearl Bailey's cookbook is great. She's written a couple of them. I'm trying to think who else who's famous, who just wrote a crazy cookbook that I like. I can't think of any now, but they're out there. I used to have a collection of them.
I was trying to find, oh, here, this is my favorite, in that family, this is my favorite.
Oh my God.
The Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous cookbook. And it's kind of incredible because it's from the 80s, but I mean, Ernest Borgnine's recipes. But it has, Ivana Trump is in here. The Kardashians are in here. I mean, it's pretty wild that these people that are in this Lifestyles in the Rich and Famous cookbook are still relevant in our culture, like 40 years later.
I now want to go buy that instantly.
Yeah.
I wrote in my piece, and your listeners may know about it already, but there's a website called Eat Your Books. You tell it what books you own. It does a list of every cookbook ever made. You tick off the ones you own. And then you can search an ingredient you want to cook with tonight.
Yes.
You know, like broccoli rabe or razor clams or whatever. And it will tell you where to find the recipes in the books you already have. And I love that because I hate the fact that I have all these cookbooks and then at dinner times here and I end up on my phone in some crappy recipe with 400 ads on top and I have to scroll 30 pages to get to the recipe, you know?
Right.
It's probably a crap. I mean, sorry, I'm sure there are great people out there, but I don't trust a lot of the stuff.
No, they got really bad. I mean, I used to be a food blogger, and like I used to have, I mean, not to brag, but I had the top result for broccoli recipe for a while, but that's gone away.
That's something.
But now,
it was
Ina Garten's roasted broccoli, which at the time when I did it, this is like, you know, I called it the best broccoli of your life. And this was back in like 2007. And it was when roasting vegetables were just starting to catch on, like the idea of like caramelizing broccoli in the oven. And so that one just took off. But now I can't even tell what these websites are that come up if you Google broccoli recipe. It's like none of them are anything I've ever heard of. And
right.
You're right. There's tons of ads and tons of weird things pop up. So
it makes me so happy to shop for a humble ingredient and then search for it, maybe in each of your books or maybe in a book. And I end up cooking from like Paul Bocuse's cookbook, the great French chef from the 70s. I'm like, here yes. I am. I'm cooking with Paul Bocuse instead of cooking with, Alex Fred out on the internet. Yeah. He's a great person, I'm sure. But Paul Bocuse is Paul Bocuse for a reason. And I'd rather be cooking his broccoli recipe than, you know, or whatever it is. His game.
Totally.
I like using my old recipes, you know?
Yeah, I just used it, Eat Your Books, the other day for meatballs. Because I was like, my friend requested I make spaghetti and meatballs. And I have Nancy Silverton's Mozza cookbook, and I would never have thought to go in there to find her recipe, but she actually chops up pancetta into the meatballs and it was so good. So I'm right there with you.
I like that.
So I'm curious, with your wife being an author too and you being a book critic, are you I'm married to a filmmaker / screenwriter, and he'll sometimes have me read his work and give him feedback, which is always a little bit fraught in our relationship because he wants a cheerleader, but he also wants me to be honest. He wants honest feedback, but he wants it coated in a layer of kindness. How does that work for you guys? Do you read her work?
I do, and we're pretty low key about it. We tend to wait. We're not the kind of couple we show every draft to. We kind of tend to wait till things are done, because we're both busy. And I don't know, I don't really like reading. I mean, maybe it's just a sign of my, I'd rather wait and read something finished than, I mean, if she wants me to read a chapter early, I'll happy to do that. But I let her have her own process, but it is fraught, it's like someone said, asking your spouse to read your book is sort of like saying, do these jeans make my ass look fat? You're not going to say, that's huge. And I'm sure my wife feels the same way about my ass, meaning my book.
So, she's not just asking her husband. She's asking the book critic for the New York Times to read her book. I mean, that's not a small thing.
we wear kid gloves. We're not too hard on each other. We try to tell the truth, Luckily, I like her writing. So,
that's great.
I hope she likes mine. So, yeah.
So are you going to go on a book tour for this book? I mean, what's the plan for it?
Not really a book tour. I have some events planned in New York, one in Boston. I'm going to Lisbon for some reason. I'm not even sure what's about the book. And a few other cities, but nothing major. It's kind of starting small. I think it's a small book that I hope there's enough of an underground audience for eaters and readers that will do okay. But I don't know. It may sell 7 copies.
But did you had fun writing it though?
Yeah, I mean, if writing ever can be said to be fun, I mean, I find having written to be fun. It's like, the best part about downhill skiing is not skiing anymore. It's like taking your boots off. You're like, oh my god, you're so happy to be at the lodge, with your mug of coffee.
Right. It's like, I think Dorothy Parker has the quote, I don't like writing, I like having written. I think that was
well, that's exactly my feeling too. So I can't say I loved writing it, but on days when it's going well, you do like it.
And did you feel vulnerable? I mean, it's very personal, the book. I mean, were these things that you'd written about before? I mean, you talk a lot about being teased growing up in school and things like that. I mean, was this the first time you've put stories like that out there in your work?
Well, maybe. I used to have a column for Esquire for 3 or 4 years, in which I was pretty personal. I don't know. I feel like I'm pretty open about my life. I feel like I'm a platter of cold cuts. Anyone can take a slice. I think Nora Ephron said that if you can take a story that's embarrassing to you and tell it yourself in a way that's funny, it's no longer embarrassing. It's just a good story. If you have control over it and realize that you can make it kind of funny, and it's tragedy recalled in Tranquility Now and in a funny way, then you kind of own it in a different way. So I don't know. I may be giving, maybe I'm saying too much, but I don't know. I don't think I reveal anything too crazily personal.
No, not at all. I was just, because the process of writing memoirs, so, it is it is like you are opening up your chest and letting things fly out. So, I mean, I think that's admirable. I'm curious, were there books before you sat down to write this? I mean, were there passages and works of literature about food that live in the forefront of your mind, like that were just the iconic food moments for you in books that you knew that you had to write about or include in this book?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I knew that I wanted to talk a bit about A.J. Liebland, who's a favorite food writer of mine. Wrote for The New Yorker in the, I think, 40s, 50s, 60s. Wrote a lot about food, wrote a lot about France, other boxing, other things. But his best book is a book about eating in France. It's called Between Meals.
I recommend it. Oh, yeah, I have that. I haven't read it yet, though.
Beautiful, beautiful book. And he has some lines in there that just stuck with me. One of them is his observation that if you're really rich, you'll probably never be, if you're wealthy, you'll always be a dilettante at the table, he wrote, because if your whole life is just ordering the most expensive cuts of meat and you're always drinking the best wine and you miss the fact that often it's good value and better tasting to get the Boudin Noir, the blood sausage, or to get a less expensive wine that's interesting and having to balance how much you can afford versus what's out there teaches you about a lot of things you might not have discovered otherwise. And that's always stuck with me because, I do fine. I get paid well by the New York Times, but I get paid well for journalism, but not for New York City. You know, it's expensive to live here, and I'm not totally. When I go out, I'm sensible to price, and eating these meals where it's $250 per head and you don't even feel like you had a big night. It's like that happens in New York, And
oh, yeah.
I could have bought a new armchair, which we need. So anyway.
No, it's funny because I'm a big Calvin Trillin fan, and I think you mentioned him in your book. And his whole thing about restaurants that are, I think he calls them La Maison de la Casa House, and it's been useful to have that in the back of my mind if I go to quote unquote a fancy restaurant in a new city or something. Because sometimes it's like, well, wait a second, this is a $300 meal, but it feels like La Maison de la Casa House, where it's just that city's version of a fancy meal versus going to some local joint that serves hot dogs or something that might be more of an authentic place. So I feel like your book captures that spirit too.
Oh, I'm glad you think so. I mean, Trillin means a lot to me too. Get it. I feel so lucky to have discovered Trillin when I was pretty young. And the reason he was great to discover is that I could have discovered a quote unquote fancier food writer. I mean, MFK Fish or someone, not that she's not healthy, but there are writers out there who are always eating the best restaurants and they write about food in that way. Trillin wrote about sausage and he wrote about fried chicken and he wrote about buffalo chicken wings. And I don't know, he opened my eyes to the fact there's glory all around us. At the time, now food culture has exploded, but 30, 40 years ago, people didn't talk about American food that way, so I really feel lucky to have had him, to have read him early. Also, I feel lucky, people don't talk about them as much anymore, but big influences on me were Jane and Michael Stern, who did those books called Road Food. Mm-hmm. And before the internet, you'd buy road food, and it was kind of a map to, you're driving around the country. We would get a map, my wife and I, and circle the road food restaurants on the map. And we're driving, we're like, oh my God, I'm only 30 miles from this place that has the best, whatever it was. So we go, and I really revere them. And I think they've fallen off the map a little bit, but they were great.
Oh yeah, I love them. I think they got divorced, sadly.
Did, but they still were writing together for a while. I don't know what's happened. Yeah. And road food is still going online, I think, but it's kind of lost a little bit of it. I think it's lost a step because everyone's doing what they did now. The culture's caught up with them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Anthony Bourdain, I think, kind of took the mantle. With Calvin Trillin, I have to say, when I lived in New York 15 years ago at the New Yorker Festival, they would have 10 slots every year to go on a tour of Chinatown with Calvin Trillin. And one year I won the tickets or whatever. And I got to do that, which was absolutely a treat. So
I'm jealous.
I feel very lucky. Well, Dwight, every podcast begins with what did you have for lunch? And it ends with what are you having for dinner tonight?
Well, I wrote about this in my Grub Street Diet. It's Tuesday. Okay. Every Tuesday for many, many years. And I love this tradition and I love it. I look forward to it every Tuesday. I'm happy because today's the day. I go to a diner. We have the same diner we go to most of the time. It's called Old John's Luncheonette near Lincoln Center. And I go with my friend, Will, who is my freshman year roommate in college.
Oh, wow.
And he'll have a grilled cheese sandwich, all the turkey club. It's a great room. It's inexpensive. And then we go see a movie. And I also love movies, you know, I love movies. And like, even, you know, I'll go see anything almost, you know, I'm like a child in front of a movie screen. We'll go see crap. I mean, we'll go see something good too, but you know, if Oppenheimer isn't playing, we'll go see, you know, The Expendables 9, you know, I you know, not really maybe, but close. And so tonight we are going to Old John's Luncheonette. Then we're seeing a movie called, I think, Creator or The Creator, which I haven't really read about yet, but it's gotten
I saw some ads for that. Yeah.
And you know what else? I probably shouldn't admit this, but I will tell you. Tuesday is the one night a week that I don't drink. And I really like drinking. I have a martini or two every night and I look forward to them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, instead of taking a dry January, I do dry Tuesday, which ends up being 52 days a year. And so go to the diner. There's not really booze there. I mean, they do have booze, but you don't really drink diners, in my opinion. You know, it's you have a iced tea or a Coke.
And so what's your dinner order at the diner? Is it a BLT?
Well, I love turkey clubs more than anything.
Turkey clubs, that's what I thought.
The bummer is this place, Old John's, which I love, got an upgrade. And their turkey club is now like on a weird roll. And it's all like, it's not really a classic turkey club. So, you know, it's pretty good, but it makes me move around sometimes my ordering. So what I really want is the classic turkey club and fries. So I make it that, but I may just get the burger.
And will you get popcorn afterwards?
No, I'm not a popcorn guy. It sticks in my teeth. I don't know what it is. I'll eat it sometimes, but I'm not a big popcorn guy. Sometimes we'll go out afterwards. My friend Will is a huge dessert guy. He's one of those guys who's really lucky to be really skinny and has always been that way. And
he loves married to somebody like that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't care about dessert. I really don't. My wife loves to cook dessert and I'll eat it, but I don't care. And I don't look forward to it. But sometimes we'll go out to like Magnolia Bakery, which is nearby after the movie, and he'll get a big slice of cake and a glass of milk, you know, and I'll sit there.
Love that. I'm more like him than I am like you. I was going to ask, I mean, since you brought up martinis and drinking one or two a night, what is your go-to martini technique/recipe?
Well, you know, I'm pretty basic. I like them very, very dry, just a tiniest amount of vermouth. And I use Gordon's. It's well brand. The Queen used to drink Gordon's. Hemingway drank Gordon's. I believe the Dreiser drank Gordon's. And I like when I go out, I'll have a Hendrix or I'll have something fancy in a restaurant. But you know, I don't want to spend $80 on my bottle of gin that I'm going to finish in 2 weeks. I don't want to do that. And I like Gordon's. You know, it's like I think it's solid. And I'm happy with it. My son now works in the sort of high-end liquor business. He's just out of college, but he's doing really well. And he's always bringing bottles over to me like, Dad, you tried this awesome thing. And a lot of them are too powerful for me. It's kind of like drinking an IPA. Like these new gins, a lot of them are really strong, really intense, juniper, and they're really forward. And some of them are too forward for me. I may have to educate my palate. But
do you have like a technique? I mean, are you putting it in a beaker? Are you stirring it? Are you shaking it? You're shaking it.
I always shake. I have friends in the cocktail world and they're horrified, you know, because they think that the right way to make a martini is to stir it. If you stir it, it never gets cold enough for me. So I like to shake it and you get those ice crystals on the surface. It's really cold. And that's what I love. So I'm not a stirring guy. And just a basic shaker. I chill the glass with a couple ice cubes and some water. And I hope there's someone around to share it with because I like to drink somebody else. But if not, I'll put on some good loud music and read and eat. Make a little plate of snacks because I like to little nibble when I'm having my martini. I look forward to it every night. I have a martini and a half probably, then a glass of wine with dinner. If I have more than that, I start worrying about my morning. So I try to, I keep it under control.
So you're still reading at night before you go to bed, or do you?
I don't. I give it up. I read all day, so I don't read at night. I mean, you know, to be honest, that's probably not fair because I read my phone at night, you know, and that's all reading. Right. You know, on the phone, I read all the newspapers, but I don't pick up a book after dinner.
That's good. Do you watch like reality TV, like The Real Housewives or something?
You know, we don't have, good question.
I didn't really think that you watched that, but it would be funny
to me if you did. No, I'm not a TV guy, really. My wife loves, great miniseries. You know, she's really into Crown and all that stuff that, you know, and I like it too, but she's really into it. So I'll watch with her like the first one, but she'll then binge, she'll watch four, you know, I'll go to bed at 9:30 after one. So.
All right. Well, Dwight, you've been such a good sport. Thank you so much for answering all of my nosy questions. And I'm so excited to get the hard copy of the book. It's such a great, great book so far. So congratulations on it.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. Your questions were great and I had a great time. So thank you.
Awesome. All right. Well, enjoy the rest of your day and have fun at the movies tonight.
All right. Thank you.
I'll see you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, that's it for this week's episode of Lunch Therapy. If you want to follow me on my cooking adventures, be sure to give me a follow at Amateur Gourmet on Instagram, TikTok, and X or Twitter. And be sure to subscribe to the Amateur Gourmet newsletter, which comes out twice a week, amateurgourmet.substack.com. All right, I'll see you back here next week. And don't forget to eat lunch.